disconnected from reality and people's needs.
The G20 summit talks weekend was accompanied by large protests. Three anti-G20 demonstrations attended by young students, left-leaning groups, climate change activists and trade unions were held in Rome between Friday and Saturday.
Il G20 è fatto da persone.
The G20 is made up of politicians who want the finance to take over politics, politicians who want our country in the hands of Brussels, Frankfurt and the Silicon Valley.
Many fear that the G20 leaders' mild pledges on climate neutrality and coal financing could result in lost momentum ahead of an upcoming crucial COP26 climate summit in Glasgow. Max Civili, Rome.
Her name means hope in Arabic. 3 years ago, a photograph of Amal Hussein showing her skin and bones sparked shock and anger across the globe. A week later, she starved to death and became a striking symbol of the catastrophic situation in the war-torn country.
The number of malnourished cases is increasing daily compared to previous years during the brutal aggression against our country. We expect that the number of malnourished children exceeds 1 million across the country. Amal Hussein was only an example of the suffering of millions of Yemeni children. What is the fault of Amal and these children who suffer from the consequences of the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia? It is the children who pay the price, unfortunately, under the coverage of the United Nations.
Amal was one of nearly 2 million children suffering from severe malnutrition in Yemen. With 3 years having passed since her death, the situation has not got any better due to the continuing food crisis in the country and the lack of medicines for children.
We receive patients from all governorates, including very bad cases that suffer from extreme poverty and are unable to provide the most basic needs of children with their medicine or food. The organizations say they provide everything, but what they receive is very little compared to what they need. And it is difficult to get medicines for malnutrition. Some parents get forced to leave the center before the treatment ends, and as a result, a large number of children die, as what happened to the child Amal Hussein back in 2018.
The years-long Saudi war and siege on Yemen have killed tens of thousands of civilians, including women and the children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, where more than 20 million people rely on aid.
Amal has died, but the hope is still alive for millions of Yemeni children who continue to suffer from the consequences of the ongoing brutal Saudi war. However, the international community, including the United Nations, has not taken any action to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the war-ravaged country. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Russian officials reported 40,993 new infections on Sunday, exceeding the previous record of 40,251 reported earlier. They also added that 1,160 people died of the virus on Saturday, three fewer than the record set on Friday. Russia's COVID-19 death count has raised to 237,380, by far the largest in Europe. Meanwhile, over 8.47 million infections have been recorded in the country of 146 million.
Most enterprises and non-essential services in Russia are closed till November the 7th, but the possibility to extend the quarantine is very likely, as it has already happened before.
In Moscow, severe restrictions have begun earlier. Almost the entire service sector is on lockdown. Schools and universities' classes have been closed as well. To cope with infection, President Putin ordered a non-working period from October 30th to November the 7th, when most state agencies and private businesses are to suspend operations.
I just don't understand what's going on. We have a reliable, effective vaccine, and there are only two ways to get through this period: get sick or get vaccinated.
Despite the ever-increasing growth of infections and endless semi-restrictions, some Russians are in no hurry to get vaccinated. Others consider them to be mandatory.
My opinion is very simple. Vaccination is a responsibility act. It should not be a matter of option. It should be mandatory. It's the only way people will be able to beat COVID. As simple as that.
This was not a mandatory part of the program. People were not forced to do it. Everything could be much better. But when we understand that conditions are being set for us, if you want to work, go get vaccinated. If you want to go to the theater, get vaccinated. If you want to eat in a restaurant, here is a QR code. Get vaccinated. This is already a cattle whip method.
About 51 million Russians, just over a third of the country's people, were fully vaccinated as of Saturday.
They may say anything they want. There are many cases of how severely vaccinated people get sick and die. Why is nobody talking about this?
Observers say one of numerous factors of cited distrust in the authorities' care can be explained by the adopted budget of the new State Duma, where in the next 2 years a reduction in health care costs by 300 billion rubles provided. It seems that plans to treat Russians with vaccines against the background of medicine optimization no longer leave illusions for people. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
While France's weekly protests against the corona vaccine pass have become greatly diminished, probably because Parliament appears certain to approve using the so-called health pass until after next spring's elections, the yellow vests continue to turn out in significant numbers nationwide. For several months, the two groups have often been conflated by the mainstream media, but the anti-vaccine pass protests are organized by a leading far-right politician, while the yellow vests disavow links to any political party, but especially the far right. The yellow vests often march in several different groups in Paris, but they share essentially the same reasons for protesting.
We will be marching every Saturday to demand our human rights and our human dignity. We are here because there is no economic justice in France. France is an oligarchy composed of political elite, union leaders, and high finance. They suck the life and riches out of the real producers of our nation's wealth, the workers.
The Yellow Vests began 3 years ago in response to record high gas prices. Around Europe, energy prices have just exploded to new records. However, there is even more economic difficulty and instability now than when the Yellow Vests first took to the streets.
Inflation is at its highest point since 2008. Back then, unemployment was 30% lower than it is today. Economic growth is widely expected to slow dramatically from this quarter onwards. The era of austerity has left France economically unprepared for the coronavirus era, and many believe that social unrest could return to the shocking levels of 2019.
In Tunisia, etc.
I think what you're seeing is similar to the revolutions which began in Tunisia and sweep the Arab world. The abuse of human liberty by our government is provoking the same type of conditions in France. They say that there is no more yellow vests. It's not true. We are right here and living on our feet instead of dying on our knees.
French media coverage of the yellow vests diminished to almost nothing in May of 2019. Just 3 weeks into season two, seemingly no domestic media witnessed the demonstrations in Paris. Contrarily, there continues to be an overwhelming police presence of seemingly one heavily armed riot cop for every two protesters, increasing the chances for provocation and violence against unarmed protesters. Armin Mazaheri, Paris.
Saudi Arabia has ordered the Lebanese ambassador to the country to leave over what the kingdom refers to as offensive remarks by the Lebanese information minister regarding the ongoing war by Saudi-led coalition against Yemen. Saudi Arabia has also imposed a ban on all imports from Lebanon. At the same time, the Saudi Foreign Ministry has expressed regret over the deteriorating relations between Riyadh and Beirut, accusing Lebanon of ignorance and failure to take corrective measures to improve the bilateral ties between the two countries. All these came amid a call by Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi for an end to the Saudi-sponsored war on Yemen, a devastating war with a simultaneous siege that have been killing and displacing Yemenis for more than 6 years now, a catastrophe that even the United Nations refers to as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Recently, the kingdom also classified a Beirut-based financial charity body as a terrorist entity, froze all the association's assets, and banned all sorts of financial transactions with it, all for the charity's ties with Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah. Lebanon-Saudi relations have been in free fall for years, but the kingdom's flagrant interference in Lebanon's internal affairs has intensified in the past few years. The highlight of that would be the unexpected resignation of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri during a trip to Riyadh under Saudi degrading treatment and pressure. A year before that, Hariri had reached a power-sharing deal with Hezbollah and had attempted to convince Riyadh of the need to work with the resistance group. In 2016, Saudi Arabia halted $1 billion worth of aid to the Lebanese army, citing the country's regional ties. Those are followed by the latest series of Saudi sanctions against Lebanon, including the prohibition of its citizens from traveling to the country. However, Riyadh does not always act alone. Similar to its conduct in Yemen with regional allies and under Western support, it pressures some other Persian Gulf countries, sometimes through threats and sometimes through leverages, to fill in its footsteps. After controversy over Hariri's resignation, Kuwait and the UAE joined the kingdom to urge their citizens to leave Lebanon. The UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait all summoned their envoys in Lebanon in protest to the recent statements of the Lebanese information minister. In 2017, the very same group of countries, alongside Egypt, collectively severed their ties with Qatar, citing a variety of reasons, including support for terrorism or Qatar's backing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, allegations that were all strongly rejected by Doha. Therefore, one can say that the current Saudi measures against Lebanon, especially at the time of heightened economic instability and insecurity, would do nothing but deteriorate the already worsening crises in the Arab country.
Saudi Arabia has banned all imports from Lebanon after criticisms of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen by Lebanon's information minister George Kordahi. The United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Kuwait also summoned their envoys to Lebanon in a protest to Kordahi's comments. The concerted move has sparked outrage in Yemen, where people have unanimously condemned it. Yemenis say Riyadh can't stop the free people from telling the truth about its years-long war on the country.
Saudi Arabia has already violated the principles of Arab solidarity and Arab commercial cooperation and other related covenants issued by the Arab League. This reveals the autocratic nature of Saudi Arabia's rulers. We see a short-sighted approach in Saudi Arabia's foreign policy. The country is seeking to silence any voice against it, whether in Yemen or elsewhere.
Meanwhile, Yemeni officials have called for banning the imports from Saudi Arabia in response to the Saudi halt on Lebanon imports.
Yemenis pay tribute to the stances of Lebanese Minister of Information, George Kordahi. His remarks made in support of Yemenis against the Saudi aggression. There are growing public calls in Yemen to ban Saudi products in solidarity with Lebanon.
In an interview on Monday, Kordahi described the Yemen war as futile and said it was time to end it. He also defended Yemen's Ansarullah movement, saying they were defending themselves against an external aggression.
People here say they will stand by the Lebanese brothers to stop Riyadh's violations of Lebanon's sovereignty. They called on the free people of the world to support Kordahi for his brave statements amid the continued international apathy toward the Saudi war on Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Come on. It's time to get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
this one lay.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Ahwai. The fallout from the statements of the Lebanese Information Minister continues. Saudi Arabia is continuing its rhetoric, but it is now focused on Hezbollah. Well, the question comes about is, what does Hezbollah have to do with this? Does the fact that Qardahi's statement that the 2015 present Saudi Arabia-led war in Yemen was an act of aggression by Riyadh and the UAE warrant such a position from Saudi Arabia on Hezbollah, saying dealing with Hezbollah-dominated Lebanon is pointless? Well, just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let's get the latest from Mariam Saleh, who's a correspondent who joins us from Beirut. So, Mariam, give us the latest on this row that has developed. And also, I'm curious about Saudi Arabia's demand. I know that they have said that the information minister should resign. And are there further statements as such coming from Saudi Arabia?
Well, we know from closed doors that the issue is not just the issue of Qardahi. We heard it also from the Saudi foreign minister himself, who said that the issue is much bigger than just the statements made by Information Minister George Qardahi, and that the issue is a confrontation with Hezbollah. They said it very clearly. So from these statements, we see that we don't have to talk about it as being an issue related specifically to those statements. However, this is the current pretext right now for the Saudis. They are saying that these are the statements that they want the minister to resign. But not only, we know closed doors that they want Najib Mikati to resign, but Najib Mikati does have, as a prime minister now, support from France and even the U.S. to stay on board. Now during the G20 summit, he is making his calls and his contacts. He is trying also to call on Minister Qardahi to resign. However, Mr. Qardahi, as being pro-resistance, as being pro-sovereignty and independence for Lebanon, is basically fighting for the fact that Lebanon has the right to freedom of speech, and this democracy in Lebanon is one of the main uniqueness of this country. And so therefore, he and those who support him in the government will continue to fight for that. However, you also have differences with other ministers, partly also the prime minister, who is also making his international calls. And we'll see if there will be some sort of pressure put by countries like France and U.S. On Saudi Arabia to back down somewhat. And they are saying that this is considered a crisis because he cannot be detached from this Arab umbrella, as Prime Minister Najib Mikati says, and some others, also loyalists to Saudi Arabia as well, say. So there is somewhat of a crisis. How this will be resolved, we're waiting to see, of course, whether there will be some sort of international or foreign intervention, and we'll see how this how it resolves.
Thank you for that. Mariam Saleh, correspondent there from Beirut. Many thanks. For your guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, American author, attorney, and former diplomat in Saudi Arabia, Michael Springman, joins us from Washington, D.C. Also joining us, journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Say, Mohsen Abbas, let me first start with you. You have the information minister. You're familiar with the statements that he has made. And we're looking at this reaction. It's really confusing and perplexing because it's not as if it's something that's so out there, the information minister has said. And it's been said by so many different officials from a variety of countries. Why do you think Saudi Arabia has taken this stance?
Because Saudi Arabia gets told what to do in terms of its foreign policy. Nothing it does is really independent of the Zionist regime in the region and, of course, the United States of America. They are hand in glove on everything that happens in that region. And it's obviously naive and rather nonsensical to talk of Saudi Arabia and its foreign policy without actually mentioning who they are, the puppets and the proxies for in that region. Of course, what generally Western analysts tend to want to push those that are supportive of the Anglo-Zionist Empire is that this is a proxy war and that Lebanon is part of a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Well, the reality is, in fact, the war exists with the Americans and the Israelis as the occupying force across the region. Lebanon is no exception. It's been under the grip of the Anglo-Zionist Empire for a very long time. They still have their proxies within Lebanon, who are primarily the ones who act as their troublemakers. And their target is, of course, Hezbollah. Hezbollah is, of course, an independent fighting force, which has its leanings towards the Islamic Republic of Iran, of course. But the primary issue is the sovereignty and the independence of Lebanon. Which of these forces is actually truthfully, for the independence of Lebanon, and which is actually operating as as a puppet of the Americans, as has been done since probably the Second World War onwards. Quite clearly, it's Hezbollah, which is the bone in the kebab. It's kind of, if I want to use an excruciating term like that or metaphor, it's a problem for Israel, Hezbollah. It's a problem for the Americans. They want the Saudis to stir things up here, to add to the pressure they've already been putting through the explosion that took place in Beirut, the economic terrorism that they've initiated, the lack of energy resources, etc., the color revolutions that they've been planning and instigating in Lebanon. All of this is just yet another part of that effort to try to bring Lebanon to heel.
Okay, so Michael Springman, you heard our guest there, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas. And with all due respect to Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, when I listen to what he has said, which all makes sense, I'm trying to figure out how the statements made there by the information minister could then be taken into that context and into that sphere. I mean, I'm looking here as him saying the UAE and Saudi Arabia act of aggression. We've heard that. He called the war absurd. It must stop because he's opposed to wars between Arabs. Or how he has said the Yemeni army is defending themselves against an external aggression. Weddings were being bombed, homes and villages and funerals. And then the Saudi foreign minister focuses on Hezbollah and says, well, you know, Hezbollah has something to do with this, or putting that into that context. Do you see this to have that kind of gravity to it?
Well, I think from where I stand, I think the Saudis, the Magic Kingdom, the apartheid entity of Israel, and the United States are attacking Iran in a new direction. Through Lebanon, as long as they can keep Lebanon upset and disturbed and in a collapsing economy and democracy, they're quite happy because they have a free hand to go after the axis of resistance, which is being supported by Iran. And I think what triggered a lot of this was not so much remarks made by the Lebanese information minister before he was appointed, or the statement made by the Hezbollah parliamentarian in Lebanon. But I think the trigger was probably the request by the Lebanese president, Michel Aoun, of the Russian government to provide the Lebanese government with satellite imagery of the explosion in Beirut back in August of last year.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's getting too close to who's involved with doing what, and providing information that is coming from a different direction from a country that supports Lebanon, that supports Syria, and that is working closely with Iran. So I think the whole thing is basically a put-up job and trying to divert attention from what is really going on.
Sure. Samuelson Abbas, in reference to what I made to the statements that you had made, it's not just disagreeing with you. I don't want there to be a misunderstanding. What I'm trying to figure out here, because I'm sure many are perhaps questioning this, is that why is it that Saudi Arabia, for a war that has been critiqued and criticized for such a long time based on the fallout, based on the deaths, based on what it has done to Yemen, could be then have Saudi Arabia directed into the different directions that it's going? One of the latest, or a couple of the latest, being that it's requiring the Prime Minister to resign. Prime Minister Mikati, behind closed doors, a correspondent said that. Aside from the information, requesting the information minister Kardahi to also resign. If you know what I mean, the fact that they're taking this to this level, perhaps is pointing to what you then said. Maybe that it's being orchestrated from different places like Washington and Tel Aviv, maybe.
Well, we have to understand that Israel is desperate. Israel had in the region unassailable military, ascendancy amongst the Arab nations. They were untouchable, invincible. Nobody would even dare to consider taking Israel on. And then came 2006, and Hezbollah laid that whole bogey to rest in the sense that Israel's inability to advance into yet another occupation of Lebanon totally shattered that myth. Subsequently, we've seen the liberation or the resistance movement in Palestine also stand up in a similar fashion. But it's this fear that the Israelis have is making them trigger the likes of Saudi Arabia, because they don't want to come front line. They can't. They've seen that they've failed before. They don't want to go head to head. So they're using all their proxies, like Kuwait, like Bahrain, like Saudi Arabia, who I must say have also pulled out their ambassadors. So you can see that there's a sort of an alliance, an axis of the puppets, if you like, which is all operating in this regard. So that's your main. That's why there's no logic to this, because Saudi Arabia itself is pummeling Yemen. It is invading that country. It has occupied that nation for decades. It has sucked its kind of resources dry. It is killing men, women, children, civilians indiscriminately. It's bombing the place to smithereens. It's getting arms supplies from the Americans. This is all on record. Nobody, absolutely nobody, can deny this. So whatever George Godai said was, first of all, it was factual. It was correct.
Exactly.
Secondly, the Saudis have been involved in this sort of business for years. They've been involved in more wars than people will really want to admit, from the Gulf War on Iraq through to the Lebanese Civil War in 76 and 79, through to the North Yemen Civil War in 62-65. If we go to the Yemen's sixth Sadr War, they were there again, 2009-10, and it's so on. 2015, they've been bombing the poorest nation in the Arab world to smithereens, and for them to begrudge a minister saying what is factually obvious is the kind of arrogant nonsense that I think the Saudis have got to get out of the habit of.
Exactly. Okay. A lot of truth to everything you said there. I'd like to turn to you, Michael Springman, and get your reaction from this soundbite we're going to play from U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham. Let's take a listen.
Nothing happens in Saudi Arabia without MBS knowing it.
Who's MBS?
He's the 33-year-old crown prince who jumped over other people. He's the son of the existing king, and I think he's on a bad track. I can never do business with Saudi Arabia again until we get this behind us.
Right. And what does that mean?
That means I'm not going back to Saudi Arabia as long as this guy's in charge.
So you're saying the crown prince has to leave?
It's up to them, but I'm not going back. I've been their biggest defender on the floor of the United States Senate. This guy is a wrecking ball. He had this guy murdered in a consulate in Turkey, and to expect me to ignore it, I feel used and abused. I was on the floor every time defending Saudi Arabia because there's a good ally. There's a difference between a country and an individual. The MBS figure is, to me, toxic. He can never be a world leader on the world stage.
So what does the president do? Sanction?
It's up to the president. But what I would do, I know what I'm going to do. We're going to sanction the hell out of Saudi Arabia. You know, we deal with bad people all the time, but this is in our face. I feel personally offended. They have nothing but contempt for us. Why would you put a guy like me and the president in this box after all the president has done? This guy's got to go. Saudi Arabia, if you're listening, there are a lot of good people you can choose, but MBS has tainted your country and tainted himself.
Okay, hopefully you've heard that, the statements coming there from Lindsey Graham. Trying to make a comparison here, Michael Springman, in terms of how Saudi Arabia comes out against another political figure, in this case in Lebanon. And then you have, of course, what the U.S. senator there said about one figure that stands obviously tall there in Saudi Arabia, and that's the Saudi crown prince.
Well, exactly. Common sense from the United States Senate is truly remarkable, and especially coming from Lindsey Graham, who, as he said, has long supported the Saudi government and all its horrible atrocities. So I think that his idea of sanctions on Saudi Arabia makes a lot more sense than sanctions on Iran, sanctions on Russia, sanctions on any companies dealing with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to Germany is a truly a good way to go. Make some use out of sanctions that are not repressive and repulsive and not aimed at destroying countries, but in this case, aimed at helping the people of Saudi Arabia get rid of a repressive and repulsive dictator. Mohammed bin Salman, he was the guy that rounded up a whole series of Saudi princes and locked them up in various hotels and took their money away from them. And he's the guy that's been clamping down on dissent within the country. And he's the guy that supervised the capture of people from outside of Saudi Arabia and bringing them back there for jailing. So I think that anything said about Mohammed bin Salman that is good is nonsense, and anything that reveals his horrible nature and his efforts to oppose any kind of opposition anywhere is good. So I think we really need to follow Lindsey Graham's advice.
So, say, Mr. Abbas, when we take a look at how Saudi Arabia has focused on Hezbollah, I'm sure that there's enough intelligence, and you don't even really need intelligence, the information is out there, for the Saudis, for the Americans, and for the Israelis to know not only how popular Hezbollah is within Lebanon, what they stand for, but also across the Muslim world, but for them to realize, you know, this is part of the government, and that really it's futile to want to take away Hezbollah out of that equation or out of the psyche of Lebanese. Why do they keep going after that?
Because it really is a matter of life or death in terms of geopolitical and geoeconomic realities and interests for America and for the Israelis. It's literally a sort of matter of survival. Now, the fact is that they're an illegitimate entity. They've robbed people of their state. They have been imposing an apartheid style regime on those people. They recognize no international law. They bomb their neighbors indiscriminately, violate their sovereignties, including Syria, including Lebanon, and anybody else who they think is not bowing or bending their knee to them. So here we have a rogue illegal state which is basically fighting for its life. So now they know that they have a real force that is to be reckoned with on their borders, and that is Hezbollah. In 2006, it has to be also evidence that when Hezbollah actually took its stand and defeated the Israelis. The Saudis were secretly approving the Israeli invasion. This is on record, and actually, their good buddies, the Israelis, actually leaked this report about 2 years after the war. So the Israeli intelligence leaked the fact that the Saudis were supporting and backing the invasion of Lebanon. Now, here you have the Lebanese people, and those who are still arguably deluded enough to think that Lebanon is their friend, that Saudi Arabia is their friend because it's given a few billion dollars here and there in order to try and buy the country, or that they think that America and Israel is going to be their friend, and they seem to be keen on supporting policies against Hezbollah and for the Anglo-Zionist Empire. They need to be reminded, and the Lebanese people need to be reminded, that you're dealing here with nations and countries who stabbed you in the back and will continue to do so, and are continuing to do so. What they just did with Samir Geagea, who was under orders to create chaos and killing peaceful Hezbollah demonstrators who are peacefully demonstrating against the corruption within the courts, which are preventing the proper analysis of the Beirut explosion. Lebanese were killed by gangsters, essentially. So, they want a return to the civil war days, chaos and destruction for Lebanon, if they can't get their hands on it cleanly, i.e. if they can't eliminate Hezbollah as a democratic existence within Lebanon, they would rather tear up Lebanon and create chaos and civil war and destruction and bring the people to their knees with energy shortages, food shortages, and the like. This is straight-on terrorism by the Anglo-Zionist Empire in league with those traitors within Lebanon, as well as the proxies of the Anglo-Zionist Empire, the Saudis and others, Egypt included, many others in that region.
Sure. I'm going to zoom in on some of those statements there that you made at the end, say, Mohsen Abbas and Michael Springman, my last question of this program. Is that maybe what the aim is here from Saudi Arabia? They've made this announcement, and they've taken this position. They have said, we're going to stop our imports to Lebanon. They're trying to perhaps stop business from happening between Persian Gulf Arab countries with Lebanon, which, as Said Mohsen Abbas said, their goal is to bring Lebanon to its knees, bring the people to their knees, and to stop any type of advancement, economic advancement, to stir up the country, which is goes in line with what Hezbollah Secretary General has said, to create the civil war within the country by obviously squeezing everybody. Do you think that's maybe a scenario that Saudi Arabia is after, to reach whatever their goals is there?
Oh, exactly right. You've got, as Mr. Abbas had said, the attacks in on the Hezbollah peaceful demonstration, that was very much like the Maidan in Kiev with people shooting into the crowd, like in Dera with people shooting into the crowd, and then trying to pretend that this somehow is a revolution brought on by the evilness of the local government. So I think that, yes, Hezbollah is the only force that's really defending Lebanon. Its army, unfortunately, and the other forces are not doing very well. But if you strike down Hezbollah and starve the Lebanese, keep their power down, make people sit around the house with candles, you've got a victory. And as long as Lebanon is in an uproar, okay, you cut off the pipeline from the sea to Syria, to Iraq, and to Iran.
Thank you very much for that, Michael Springman, American author, attorney, and former diplomat, Saudi Arabia, talking to us there from Washington, D.C. Many thanks. Said Mohsen Abbas, a pleasure, journalist and political commentator there from London. Many thanks. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikovit Takwa, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you might remember, we talked about Imam Khomeini's recommendations on supporting the oppressed and fighting the oppressors, especially the global arrogance and Zionism. We will continue the discussion in this episode. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, in his testament stresses that one of the main problems of the Islamic countries and oppressed nations are the mercenary regimes of these countries. He believes that these regimes try to keep these nations weak, backward, and dependent. He writes, "At least for the recent 100 years, that the big world-devouring powers gradually put their steps in the Islamic countries and other small countries, we have witnessed or have been told by correct histories that none of the ruling governments in these countries have thought of their nation's freedom, independence, and welfare. Almost all of them have rather been engaged in oppression and suffocation of their nation or have only tried for their vested or group interest, or for the welfare of the wealthy and upper class, and the oppressed slum habiting classes have been denied all life blessings such as water and bread, and those miserable have been employed for the interest of the wealthy and debauchee stratum, or they have been the puppets of big powers, which have employed whatever they can to make countries and nations dependent and have made countries the markets of the East and the West through different tricks and have secured their interest and have raised nations backward and consumers, and they are moving with the same plan."
Thank you.
Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, "The misery for Muslims are the governments that are dependent on the East and the West, and I emphatically recommend you not to listen to the propaganda horns of the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic, which all try to expel Islam from the scene so that the interests of the superpowers are secured." Imam Khomeini also writes, "O you, the oppressed of the world, and you, the Islamic countries and Muslims of the world, stand up and grasp the right with hands and teeth, and do not be scared of the propaganda ballyhoo of superpowers and their servile stooges, and expel from your countries the criminal rulers who submit your efforts to your enemies. And expel from your countries the criminal rulers who submit your efforts to your enemies. And you and the committed serving classes take the helms of affairs and gather together under the flag of Islam to rise up for defense against the enemies of Islam and the deprived of the world." Imam Khomeini believed that confronting the media hype of the oppressive powers is the main duty of Muslims. He writes, "Today and in the future, what must be important for the Iranian nation and the Muslims of the world is the foiling of the disuniting and destructive propaganda." Elsewhere in his testament, the Imam writes, "I recommend Muslims, particularly the Iranians in the current era, to show reaction against conspiracies, increase their solidarity and unity in any possible way, and disappoint the disbelievers and the hypocrites." Imam Khomeini says, "The prominent ulema and respectable preachers of the Islamic countries should invite governments to free themselves of dependence of big powers and come to mutual understanding with their nation, as, in this way, they will embrace victory. And let them invite nations to unity and refrain from racism, which is opposite to Islam. And let them shake the hands of fraternity with their brothers in faith in any country and from any race, because the great Islam has called them brothers. And if this brotherhood in faith materializes through the efforts of governments and nations with the help of Almighty God, you will see that Muslims will form the greatest power in the world, with the hope of the day on which, God willing, this fraternity and equality will materialize." Imam Khomeini also writes, "I recommend the Islamic nations to take the role model of the Islamic Republic government and the Iranian struggling nation to put the oppressive governments in their place. If they do not capitulate to the will of their nations, the source of misery of Muslims are the governments that are dependent on the East and the West."
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.